You go work, 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 work.
Ooh, you know, Rihanna's song wasn't out yet. Maybe it was inspired by Stat School.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
Mina,
exactly.
You really just solved the mystery for me.
You know.
She's a big sabermetrics. A
lot of value add.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot-caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got keyboard. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, and there at 538 to my right, Neil Payne, stalwart sports writer at 538. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Chad. How's it going?
And across the table from us, with Kate Fagan still on book leave, is the one and only Mina Kimes, ESPN, the magazine senior writer. Hi, Mina.
Hey, guys. What's up?
Thanks for coming on.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having
your,
me.
Your Hot Takedown 538 debut. We're big fans.
Thank you. This is my second ESPN podcast today. I recorded one this morning with Bill Barnwell about The Bachelorette that we do weekly. We also bring a rigorous analytical approach to that.
Is Chad still in it?
Unfortunately, Chad is no longer in it.
So, Neil, I'm not sure if you're following Bachelorette as closely as even I am, which is not very closely. But my understanding is that this contestant on The Bachelorette is not actually named Chad. He's the heel of the season, right? And he's not actually named Chad, but he changed his name to be Chad so that he could sound more jerky.
He changed his last name to Chad Johnson. So he pulled a reverse Ocho Cinco. That is his name. That's not his given name.
So hold on. So the guy still has the first name, Harry or Henry or something.
His first name is Chad. Gosh, I can't even remember. I think he had a different last name.
Oh, I see. I read that he changed his first name to Chad so that he could sound like more of a jerk, which really made me feel good.
Yes.
Is Chad a jerk name?
Absolutely. Okay. That's without a doubt.
Really, that's why you go by
right.
Chad.
It's
Chad
like
Wick.
JT.
My parents totally did not foresee the lacrosse bro era of the
Chad's
of Chad.
Never going to be president.
That's true. That's a good point. All right. On today's show, the NFL makes its return to Hot Takedown. It has been so long. We're going to talk about Von Miller, who all of a sudden has become sort of a labor warrior within the NFL.
It's funny how that happens.
I know.
When your contract's up.
Yeah, exactly. The Broncos linebacker and Super Bowl MVP says he will not let the Broncos apply the franchise tag to him, which may mean that Miller doesn't play at all this year. We'll talk about whether the franchise tag distorts the way players get paid in the NFL with Mina, who specializes in this kind of thing. And then baseball is at the All-Star break, and we are still talking about Daniel freaking Murphy. For Mets fans, at least, that middle word is necessary. We will take stock of Murphy's brilliant first half and also some other baseball topics, whether the Indians are for real, for example, and why the league can't stop hitting home runs. And then we're going to do sort of like a double sig dig, I think. One is going to be about Tim Duncan, who announces retirement this year, and the other is a special superlative that this week holds. This week contains the deadest sports day of the year, by Neil Payne's counting, at least. All right, moving on to our first segment. With Mina here, we wanted to talk about sports business, since she writes about that for ESPN the magazine. And sure enough, Von Miller is in the news for being a kind of crusader against what he sees as an unfair compensation system in the NFL. So, Mina, can you brief us on what's happening for those of us who have not paid attention to the NFL in the last, let's say, 4 months or so?
Well, it was the last time you paid attention to the Super Bowl, because that's the last time Von Miller was
great.
Sort of
this
on
is
the
good news
stage.
For me. Good.
Yeah, so, you know, as everyone remembers, Von Miller basically destroyed the world in the playoffs. I mean, he was an earth-shattering force that could not be contained and was in the Super Bowl MVP after wrecking Tom Brady's soul. He then proceeded, you know, to wreck Cam Newton's soul. And the Broncos rewarded him with a $14 million franchise tag in March. For those who don't know, teams can designate their best player with the tag. There's exclusive and non-exclusive tags.
That sounds like an honor. I would love for 538 to designate me the franchise editor. That sounds great.
Well, what it means is Von Miller, who's, you know, coming off of the fifth year of his rookie contract, he was a first-round pick, which means you can get a fifth-year option, which we should talk about as well, did not get to test the free agency market and find out what his true value is. which I can tell you is a lot more than $14 million. He was very angry about this, and him and the team have gone back and forth all summer. Certain Instagrams featuring John Elway were cropped. Things were said to TMZ. And the latest thing from Von Miller is he said he's not going to play in the franchise tag. He'll hold out. And he also said it's a league-wide problem that I feel I'm in a situation to help with.
I love the Crusader. I love when athletes become Crusaders for whatever cause they want to become Crusaders for. All right, so before we get into the ramifications of the franchise tag, let's listen to this take from ESPN's Mike Golic.
You're telling John Q. Public out there, I love everybody, but there's no way I'm playing this year for $14 million. And while I and inside of football understand your train of thought in this, you lose when you try and go public with this. You lose because that's what people are going to say. They're not going to say, oh, I understand his plight. Boy, I hope he gets his $60 million guaranteed. They're not, Vaughn. They're not. They're not going to understand it. You don't ever win talking money to the public and trying to get them to take your side, to take a millionaire side over a billionaire side.
So let's leave this sort of PR war aspect out of that, but I'm wondering sort of, Mina, should we be sympathizing with Von Miller?
First of all, who is John Q. Public?
Yeah, right.
Is he on the Trump ticket? I mean, do I know him? So look, if you are in favor of people getting paid what they're worth, you cannot support the franchise tag, right? It's an anti-capitalist tool. What it does, it says that the best, most talented players should not be paid what they're worth. NFL contracts are all about leverage. What a player gets paid is never actually a reflection of what they're worth. It's a reflection of their leverage and the team's leverage. What the tag does is it gives leverage to the team to then go in and create a long-term contract, which is probably what will happen with Von Miller, guys. He's probably not going to hold out. That very rarely happens. But what it gives them is leverage to make a contract that does not reflect Von Miller's value on the free market. Now, that has a trickle-down effect because players like Von Miller and Andrew Luck and whatever, Russell Wilson, don't actually enter free agency. These contracts do not rise for stars as quickly as they should, and then the next player doesn't get paid as much as he should. So Von Miller, while maybe not exactly a champion of the people in John Q. Public, what he's saying, it does affect players other than the very few who are franchised every year.
So why did the Players Union agree to it?
So the franchise tag was created in the early 90s as the league transitioned into free agency so that, I guess, ideally small market teams could keep their star players like, you know, your Dan Marinos or whatever back then. Now, in an era of a hard salary cap, that doesn't make any sense. Teams can only keep a certain amount of star players anyways. There's no reason why the franchise tag should exist. However, you know, it does exist. It's been renewed in every CBA. And in fact, in the latest CBA, a lot of people don't know this, it was actually recalibrated to be worse for players. It used to be calculated based on the previous year, the top five players average. Now it's the previous 5 years. So for a while after the 2011 CBA was instituted, the tag actually didn't rise for a few positions. I think safety, for example, I don't have in front of me, maybe even defensive linemen. So the tag numbers were actually not going up because of the new equation.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing that, you know, it really is like a freeze on the earning power of the players that should actually be making more, seeing their salaries accelerate even more. And yeah, it's so funny because the term franchise player has always kind of sounded like an honor, like you said earlier, Chad, and seemed like, you know, kind of something that you would want. But it's always been used as this tool to suppress the ability to test the market on the part of the players that should be able to kind of test it the most.
So in every, well, I don't know about every, but in the NBA, there's a max contract. Mm-hmm. Salary cap leagues tend to have this kind of thing that will suppress some players' value and worth, right?
Right. And I think, you know, it is very similar to the max contract, right? I think it might be less palatable in football to players. You know, it is 1 year, and because players get injured so much more often, it creates such risk. It shifts all of the risk from the team to the player. Let's say Von Miller takes this $14 million deal and tears his ACL. Then he loses potentially like $50, $60 million. But, you know, that doesn't happen as often in the NBA, right? So it is, I think, a little bit more sinister in the NFL from a player's perspective.
Yeah, it's like a non-negotiable one-year contract that the team can keep renewing, which does kind of bring to mind, you know, Curt Flood fought the reserve clause in Major League Baseball in the 60s. Obviously, the players were not being paid some, you know, arbitrary, you know, number that represented the average of the top five or the, you know, however many players. So they were, it was even worse of a situation, but it, in some ways it hasn't really improved that much in the decades since we feel like we've broken down all these barriers for athletes and their earning power.
And it's similar to the NBA in that, look, this is, they have a hard salary cap. So if Von Miller doesn't make $20 million next year, that money's going to other players. You see more mid-level veterans benefiting from the fact that stars' salaries are capped.
Right, and the other thing is quarterbacks really rarely, at least my perception is that they rarely use the franchise tag on quarterbacks who are actually, for most teams, the franchise player of the organization in a lot of cases.
Yeah, it's ironic, right? Kirk Cousins actually was tagged this year, I think, because the Redskins truly don't know what they have with him, and they really do want to see, and he, in, by turn as well, wants to establish his value on the free market. But you're right, and I think that is because of injuries in small part. You know, these teams are more comfortable locking down quarterbacks to huge contracts, and why wouldn't they before the market goes up again? So you don't see it happen as often.
So are there players without franchise? Would that have like ways out of franchise tags? Or this
it's
is
very rare. So, you know, last year I wrote a story about Darrell Revis, who is very famous for getting paid what he is worth over his time in the NFL. He's, you know, made over $100 million cash. Doing some very interesting and kind of unusual moves with his contracts. He held out as a rookie, which in itself, you know, almost never happens. And he got a contract that voided after a few years. With his second contract, he got the Jets to bake a no franchise clause into his contracts. So then when he came up again, the Jets did not have that leverage against, all about leverage, against him, and they had to trade him.
And how rare is that to have a no franchise clause?
I mean, it almost never happens anymore. I think Ndamukong Asamoah, like it, in the latest CBA era, I can't think of many examples.
Because teams just don't let it. They would never be so foolish as apparently the Jets were to let that happen.
So, okay, so what's the end game here? I mean, it sounds like you think Miller will sign a bigger contract. The Broncos will cave. I guess, yeah, the Broncos would cave in that instance. But
well, depends on the contract.
Right. So, but when the CBA comes around to be renegotiated, is this the, I mean, if could Miller alone have the impact that, you know, the players union as a whole wakes up to how discriminatory the franchise clause is and franchise tag is and removes it from football going forward?
The only way I think a player could get it baked into that is if a rookie quarterback like a Jared Goff or something said, yeah, you know what, I'm just not going to play. And the team was so desperate that they agreed to do it. But then I don't know if there would be a trickle effect. I don't know if other players would be able to get that. It's like when we talk about guarantee contracts, you know, people are always saying, oh, NFL players should get fully guaranteed contracts. Well, okay, they could ask for them. You know, it's not a CBA thing. But what forces teams to actually do that? And it's very, very rare in the NFL that a player actually has that level of power over a team.
Do you think there might be a chance that it could just get phased out automatically, or that the way football works might cause it to shift? Because I'm noticing, like, some of the smarter organizations like the Patriots and the Ravens, they actually franchise their kickers. Which is that just a case of like throwing away the franchise tag? You know, why wouldn't they apply it to a player who was kind of a higher impact player?
Well, that's all very strategic. So like Justin Tucker, you know, but the Ravens was franchised, so they'll probably do a deal with him. It's just a matter of locking him down, keeping him from, you know, being a free agent and then getting the deal they want. I don't see it going away, honestly. The franchise tag has been such an unbelievable boon for NFL teams over the last, you know, decade or so, and it continues to suppress the salaries of stars. Why would you ever give that up?
So I understand why the owners wouldn't want to give that up, but it's not, you don't also don't see it, therefore, as being something that the player would be willing to walk over. This is not the kind of thing that players would say, listen, we're not signing a new collective bargaining agreement if the franchise tag is still there. And
right.
In my mind, which is a relatively uninformed one on these issues, I could see, you know, 10 really good players band together, Von Miller included, let's say, mm-hmm. who have been quote-unquote victim of the franchise tag in the past and say, listen, guys, we are not signing this contract because our best players are not being paid what they're worth.
This cuts to the problem with the NFL's union, which, you know, people are always like, oh, it's so weak. It is wildly stratified, and there are so many different players with so many different career trajectories. You know, yeah, Von Miller doesn't want a franchise tag, but the aforementioned hundreds of veterans who benefit from having the salaries of stars suppressed, do they agree? Do the players who only play 2 years in the NFL, you know, the NFL average tenure is only 3 years, do they care? So I think because there are so many incentives for different players, it has been set aside as an issue, even though there is a massive trickle-down effect.
And so that does kind of sound like the NBA in some sense, in which like the suppression of the stars' salary in the salary capped league, in which there's a piece of the pie that has to be divvied up to every player. The middle class and the lower, you know, kind of class of players take money basically out of Von Miller's pocket.
Absolutely, yeah. Which is why it's so interesting in the NBA that the stars are leading the union now. So we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, it does make me wonder, what would the stars have to give the quote-unquote scrubs or the average players in the NFL within the union or within the contract and to make them support the doing away with the franchise tag, right? What is that kind of horse trading?
And there are different kind of stars, right? You were just talking about quarterbacks. Like, quarterbacks' incentives are wildly different from Von Miller's incentives. They don't care about the franchise tag as much as, you know, your defensive lineman who's getting his brain knocked. So it is a very, very difficult league to organize.
Very interesting. All right. Let's leave it there for now. Baseball is halfway over, more or less, and there are all sorts of storylines going into the All-Star break, and none more pressing for Mets fans than what has gotten into Daniel Murphy over the last few months. Murphy's Nationals are 6 games up on the Mets, in part because of Murphy's heroics in 12 games against the Mets. He's hitting .438, slugging .875. OPS of .875. He's got 7 homers. 21 RBIs. You know what? I think it's slugging .875. Isn't that even crazier? That's crazy.
Yeah. That's a number that's like should be an OPS and is actually a slugging.
7 homers, 21 RBIs. His average on the season is .352. His OPS on the season is .985. Neil, is 2016 Daniel Murphy the real Daniel Murphy?
Oh, man. Certainly that's not what the Mets thought after the going into the offseason in which they kind of ditched him in favor of Neil Walker, which I think the stat heads kind of thought was a good move at the time. And then Murphy has come out and, first of all, against everyone, just scorched the earth like you were talking about, and then particularly against the Mets. You know, there's not a very long list of players who at age 31 suddenly kind of find that they were this diamond in the rough and kind of, become Hall of Fame type players overnight. And certainly Murphy was a pretty good hitter beforehand. If you look at his career stats going into this season, he had a work plus, if you remember the stat that we talked about one time in stat school, of 109, meaning he was 9% better than the average hitter. That's pretty good. Especially for a middle infielder. But this season, he's 57% better than average. And
157 work plus?
Yes, exactly.
He's working it.
Yeah, work plusing it. And so if you look at kind of the all-time history of baseball and try to find players who were in their 30s that had that much of a improvement on their career average, it's not a long list. Murphy is only the 21st player to kind of boost it by about 50 points.
He's the 21st best. You're saying there have only been 21
players
who have
done this
before?
Well, it's the 21st best improvement. There have been only 20 other players that kind of improved by as much. And the really interesting thing is that the top of that list is populated by a lot of guys from the PED era. 3 Barry Bonds's, a Sammy Sosa, Ken Caminiti, a Javi Lopez, Brett Boone, Luis Gonzalez. There's also some Mark McGuire and some Brady Anderson down on that list. So those are the types of players. I'm in no way, shape, or form casting aspersions on Daniel Murphy, because there's also guys like Ricky Henderson on there, Paul O'Neill, somebody named Dixie Walker, who I really had never heard of, but certainly sounds like an interesting fellow. So Willie Stargell had a season like this. So it is possible. It has happened in the history of baseball, but it's exceedingly rare to have it only happen 21 times in more than a century.
So, Mina, one question I have for you. So we should declare to you and out ourselves as Mets fans. One of the things that that's been sort of that I've been wondering is whether or not a fan's perception that there can be such a thing as a team killer. You know, just that one player on arrival that always seems to hurt your favorite team or whatever it is. If that's a real thing, and do you feel like that as you know, when you're watching sports, you know you're a big Seahawks fan.
Yeah, I'm a Mariners fan. Okay. And for us, we own the killer. So Felix Hernandez was very famous for just slaying the Oakland A's for years. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they really were quite remarkable. And because they're a divisional opponent, you know, the sample size was big enough to people were like, oh, this is like a thing. Like, we don't like playing Felix Hernandez. Obviously, the whole, you know, players play better when they have a sense of vengeance is probably not a real thing, I guess. I haven't pulled the numbers on it. Maybe you guys can tell me wrong. I was trying to think in football some examples. I thought of Brett Favre coming back with Minnesota in that first Green Bay game, throwing, I think, 4 touchdowns. But it probably doesn't have any statistical backing.
And even if it is a thing, I would think maybe in football it would be easier to be a thing, because in baseball as a hitter, you're kind of just reacting. Like, maybe even Felix Hernandez as a pitcher might be able to kind of dig down and throw, you know, maybe some extra stuff or something like that in those particular starts if he wanted to kind of get revenge or take it to the A's, I guess, in that case. But in baseball, hitting a baseball is all about just reacting. You can't try harder and do better. In fact, you probably actually do worse. You often hear about guys pressing.
Yeah, and you'd think actually that with Murphy, the Mets would be maybe perhaps better equipped to play. You know, and it's so brutal for you guys, I'm sure. When you read all these articles about, you know, this renaissance he's having, there's always an obligatory paragraph how he learned it all from the Mets hitting coach.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, how, oh yeah, he's crouching lower and he's, you know, crowding the plate and his ground ball raised down. So you'd think that the Mets would maybe be better against him with some inside intel. Obviously, the opposite is happening.
Yeah.
Any thoughts, Chad?
I just the last week has been brutal.
Yeah,
we
even
talk
had
about
a,
this on
I had a moment where
the Mets,
I thought that the MLB app was wrong and showing like a feed from a previous game, because I was like, there's no way that he did this again. But it was true.
Okay, so let's move on from Murphy and go to the Indians. Neil, you wrote this week, I think it was this week, about the Indians in late June, early July. They won 14 in a row. At the and are now 6.5 games ahead of the Tigers in the AL Central. I feel like the Indians' renaissance has been promised for a long time,
right.
And coming into the season, the hip sabermetric types, very hip, those sabermetric
types.
Oh, sure.
We're known for that.
You know, they had forecasted that this Indians team was going to be very good because of the rotation in part and because of prospects coming up and having been in the league 1 or 2 years in some cases. They started out very poorly and now are on fire. So, Neil, what Indians team am I supposed to believe?
Yeah, like you said, this was a team that people had been kind of waiting on, and the stats, considered them to be the favorites. In fact, actually listening to those stats, Sports Illustrated put them on the cover of their baseball preview last season, and it did not go well for them or for the Indians. And so when it was time to run the projections again this season, people were skeptical of the Indians, especially since they played in the same division as the defending world champ, Royals, who famously also had like horrendous projections that also didn't work out for the computers the year before. So there's probably every reason to believe that, to be skeptical of the Indians. And this season, they've played a lot better. Like you said, they had the 14-game winning streak. And I think the difference for them is the quality of the defense and also the position players. We knew that they had a good pitching staff. Certainly, their pitchers, in addition to Kluber, they've gotten Carlos Carrasco and Danny Salazar have kind of stepped up as Cy Young candidates. And they might have one of the best rotations, if not the best in the American League. But I think also you're seeing some breakout performances by, you know, their lineup and especially on defense helping those pitchers. And that was part of the, like you said, the promised renaissance was going to be that they would get some young players actually kind of contributing. And they've had moments like this before. It's sometime around the mid-2000s, the Indians seemed like they were on the verge of kind of regaining that form that they had in the 90s. We all remember those teams with Manny Ramirez and Jim Tomei and guys like that. You're shaking your head, Mina. I would imagine
the Mariners have
some history with that. But that rebuild never really came to fruition. And it seems like kind of now hope is renewed in Cleveland. And that would be a punchline in the past. But I think after, you know, what we saw with the Cavs, maybe this is a good time for them as a city. Who knows? Anything can happen.
Cross sports success bleeding over. I like that.
Believing in contagion doesn't sound very analytics.
Oh, completely not. No, I don't think so.
So one question I have is, when teams that are young like this break through for a half season, is that suggest that they're about to break through for five seasons? You know what I mean? Like, if our expectations are that they're gonna, that we're at the beginning of an upswing, is it rare for a team to be good when young and then not to be good for 3 or 4 years in a sport like baseball, where you tend to have control over your own players? Did you know what I'm saying?
Right, yeah. No, I mean, my guess would be that teams that are good, you know, all else being equal, if you had one team that was, you know, good and young and one team that was maybe good and in their prime, you'd expect the young one to win more over the next 5 to 10 years, sure.
Yeah, I guess maybe you could also address it at the prospect level, which is if a player is supposed to be good and scrapped in the early days of in the league, in his early days in the league, and then has a breakout season like Bryce Harper last year, right? Whatever he hit, whatever it was, 320/330 last year, finally realized all his potential. This year, he's still slugging, but he's down to 260. Is it rare for a player to sort of emerge onto the scene, to be highly touted, then emerge onto the scene, and then his performance is subdued, and then could that extrapolate out to a team?
Well, yeah, I mean, I get the sense that players who are kind of in that stratosphere, and to be fair, nobody on the Indians is quite there yet, that those players tend to stay in that kind of rarefied territory of players, because those are like generational players. It's almost like a situation where no player that puts up the kind of season that Bryce Harper did is going to ever be kind of a below average player. That kind of season just doesn't, you know, we're just talking about Daniel Murphy, but Harper is kind of was on a different level even last year for a whole season than Murphy's first half has been this season. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that's almost like proof positive. There was something that Bill James came up with years ago that was called like signature performance, or kind of, I think it was like no players that have certain accomplishments were ever bad players. So if you have one of those, the odds are very high that you are one of those type of, you know, Hall of Fame type players, or, you know, really good franchise players, more so than you're an average player and you just got lucky.
All right, let's move on to home runs. They keep hitting home runs in baseball. The story league-wide going into the All-Star break seems to be that the power developments of last season have not gone away, that this year already there are three – for every plate appearance, there's a home run on 3.04% of them. So basically 3 out of every 100 plate appearances results in a home run. That would be higher than any season in MLB history. The next highest would be 2.99% in 2000, which is in the heat of the PED era, which Neil, you mentioned earlier. Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, says it's not steroids. That it may
what
be
a su- what a I surprise
know, that it may be that teams are batting home run hitters higher in the lineup, and so therefore
it sounds bogus, but okay.
Therefore they're getting more shots at it. And Mina, I wonder, you know, in a post steroid era, I don't know where you come down on the steroid debate in sports.
It's all relative, right? I think we can call it a post steroid era, given what the era was
sure.
before.
And so, do you, when you see inflated numbers as a sports fan, do you assume that there might be something nefarious, quote unquote, going on beneath them?
Well, I remember you guys did that excellent investigation a few months ago into some of the reasons, and it was excellent despite the fact that there was no answer, right? I mean, there, you looked at the science of it, the strategy of it, the players, the rookie, everything, and there
right.
is no...
We should mention that Rob Arthur and Ben Lindbergh, two of our writers, tested balls. Like, they sent baseballs away to see if they were more tightly
yes.
wound and therefore going further or faster off the bat. And as you said, Mina, there wasn't.
Right. So, yeah, then your first reaction is, okay, well, there's foul play or you know, something's afoot. And that's possible. I don't know. But I was just reading a quote from John Lester from a couple days ago where he said, I know our hitting coach wants you to hit the ball in the air. There's no slug on the ground. Guys are willing to take their punch outs to hit the ball in the air, which makes you think that it might be psychological or intentional, or there might be some sort of strategic element behind it that has nothing to do with sort of quantifiable facts.
Yeah, almost like because of the makeup of Major League Baseball players now versus in, you know, the 80s or even in the early 2000s, once the steroid era kind of started to die down, you would expect them to be just more power-oriented players.
Right.
And that was something that we were kind of waiting on. You know, strikeouts have gone through the roof, and it was considered an epidemic a couple of years ago because normally you would think, oh, they're trading strikeouts, like you said, you know, getting your cuts and taking your whiffs in exchange mm-hmm. for hitting more home runs. And a few years ago, offense was way down because that just the home run equation of it wasn't there. It was all a lot of strikeouts and a lot of guys, you know, taking that all-or-nothing approach, but they weren't actually having the power to offset it. And so I don't know if that was like just the growing pains that the sport went through as it was transitioning fully toward this model of having guys that are willing to strike out more than ever before by an order of magnitude compared to previous generations of baseball players, but also getting the power finally as part of that exchange. And it just took a few years. And we're all panicked about the lack of offense. We didn't realize that the game was going through this transition into like this new era. That sounds, you know, that sounds like a good explanation for it. But also, like you said earlier, we don't really know right now. It's kind of
all
still
of these things
up
are so tautological,
air.
Right? We're like, guys are hitting home runs because our guys are trying to hit more home runs because guys know that, you know, it's like at what point is it sort of the chicken and egg? Or is it because guys are throwing harder? Are guys throwing harder because, you know, where does it actually be? Where does a trend begin? And it doesn't seem like anyone knows yet.
Yeah, one thing that I was thinking about is how much this relates to the 3-point quote-unquote debate in the NBA, which is that the NBA is taking more 3-pointers than ever. I think we've talked about on the show before, and whether that's good or bad for the league or whether the league needs to adjust and build a 4-pointer or something like that. In baseball, you could be seeing something similar here, which is that baseball is trying to maybe maximize the runs taken on every swing, let's say, right? That quote that you just read was about there being no slug in mm-hmm. on the ground or something like that, right? If baseball teams are emphasizing slugging percentage to their hitters, and maybe the hitters are responding, and maybe the teams want to emphasize that because they realize that that's the way to maximize win probability, and on it goes. But what's different about baseball is you choose whether or not to take home run swing. The reaction once you make that choice is quite different than choosing to take a 3-pointer, in my mind, because there's so much variability about the pitch that's coming in, whether or not that pitch is able to be turned around for a home run. Whereas a 3-point shooter, there is, aside from how close the defender is, which I at least in my mind doesn't affect that decision in quite the same way, or doesn't affect the result in quite the same way.
So do you think, for example, in baseball, then you might see a subtle shift away from flamethrowers towards guys with more command who are better at placing the ball and less likely to, you know, get home runs hit off of them?
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, the strike zone, one of the reasons that was offered up for the drop in run scoring is that the strike zone was getting bigger and it was also getting lower. And so maybe somebody that can throw that low strike. But I'd be curious to see, and I haven't seen anything this year, as to whether the umpires have actually kind of noticed that, and maybe the change is happening at the strike zone level. And I think you mentioned before, balls being up in the zone more as a consequence that they know that they can't get the strikes low like they have been, might, in addition to cutting down on, you know, or increasing walks and getting you into good counts, could be leading to more home runs and more power.
All right. Yeah, we should also note that in the NBA, when the three-pointer was first came around.
The ABA, right?
Sorry, the ABA. George Mikan, yes, said, quote, "We called it the home run because the three-pointer was exactly that. It brought fans out of their seats." That kind of on-the-spot quote lookup, that's what a producer does. That's Joe Sykes right. in the booth. Let's leave it there for now and move on to our two significant digits. Neil, you are so often the sig dig bringer lately. You know, how's that burden
that
feeling?
Feels good.
Yeah, okay.
I like digits.
You've worked up those,
like...
those muscles of carrying the sig yeah. digs all the way here. Neil, what do you have for us?
These sig digs, there's a pair of them, and they're 17 and 10, and that's the number of points and rebounds, respectively, that Tim Duncan averaged per 36 minutes every single year of his career, except this past one when he was 39 years old. So for 18 consecutive seasons between 1997/98 and 2014/15, Tim Duncan was good for 17 points and 10 rebounds every night. Book it. And that really speaks to the consistency that he brought. He retired on Monday, and you know, a lot of people had a lot of great things to say about him. He's, you know, going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer. He's one of the probably top 10, if not higher, players of all time. But just that consistency, I felt like kind of spoke the most to his value as a player, is just that he was always there. And really, the Spurs they won 70% of their games, including the playoffs, during his time there. And he's second all time only to Bill Russell in career defensive win shares. He's probably the best two-way player in NBA history if you take his offense and his defense together. So it just was a remarkable body of work that it's kind of sad to see him leave the league. But again, it was like the typical kind of low-key announcement of his retirement.
Yeah, Duncan, how many championships did he win?
Five.
Wow. That's 70%.
And people don't really talk about it.
Yeah, 70% of games won and five championships. It's just, you know, we talk on the show a lot about whether – championships matter more or just winning games matters more and what the actual like best way to evaluate someone is. And in Duncan's case, you don't have to choose. You know, you get both. You get the sort of like English soccer style best record in the league, however many years that happened for the Spurs, and then also the five championships.
You know who definitely roots for Tim Duncan?
Who?
Joe Q Public.
For sure. Public's a big San Antonio fan.
Totally. He would be.
All right, the second sig dig I'm bringing, it is a very simple one. It is zero. It is the number of games on the schedule for the four major sports leagues tomorrow, which is Wednesday. Zero baseball games, zero hockey games, zero football games, and zero basketball games. However, the MLS and the WNBA are still in action, not necessarily tomorrow, but this week, this down week. And it got me thinking, like, what should they be doing to grab our attention more? And I started thinking about the Winter Classic as this like great sports gimmick and stunt that still doesn't violate the sanctity and the integrity of the game, right? In the sense that it's a gimmick, but it's not so distant from what's played every night in the NHL that you feel like, well, it just doesn't count. You know, like you can't count that. And so, like, what's the version of that for the WNBA, or what's the version of that for MLS? I thought back to that basketball game that was played on the Air Force carrier. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. The college basketball game? Like, should the WNBA do like a full like game on a playground sort of court instead of in the stadium? Like, what's the thing that's gonna make the WNBA lead SportsCenter this week?
I think we can do better than a playground court, right? Like, can't they play in like outer space or something?
Ooh.
If we're reaching for the stars.
Very interesting. Well, I feel like all of these gimmicks, and maybe the Winter Classic is less so because it is ice and it's usually played in somewhere cold where there's snow on the ground. But in some cases, like that aircraft carrier game, wasn't like the deck really wet at one point and there was a concern that players might slip? I feel like there's a trade-off between the gimmickiness of the venue and the safety. And certainly going to outer space might also push that. But I do have to commend the NHL for just the strategy of doing it on New Year's, because when we looked at the dead times of the sports calendar, obviously this week is the kind of one that everyone thinks about. But on average, there were just as few games from the Big Four sports in the last week of December, basically leading up to New Year's, as there were in this time of year in early to mid-July. And so, you know, that's another way in which this league that kind of needs the attention can latch on to the lack of competition in a lot of ways. And certainly there's college football going on at that time as well. But maybe it's all about targeting, you know, maybe it's less the gimmick and more the scheduling, you know, the purity of the scheduling.
Listeners, if you have ideas about how to get the MLS WNBA on our radars in the middle of summer.
Or into outer space.
Or into outer space. On our radar in outer space. Podcasts at 538.com. We want to figure this out for the good people of the MLS and WNBA. All right, guys, that'll do it for this week's show. Mina, how do you feel?
I feel great. Okay. So excited to celebrate Dead Day tomorrow.
Absolutely. With Joe Q Public.
With Joe Q Public.
With you and Joe hanging out. Neil, thanks as always.
Sure. Of course.
For those of you who are new to Hot Takedown, you can subscribe at iTunes.com/538 or on whatever podcast app is your favorite when you're in iTunes. And you know what? Even if you aren't new to Hot Takedown and you like the show, can you please, please, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes? It's, you know, all these podcasts say to do it. It seems like just something people say, but it actually really does change where we're ranked and how we surface within iTunes when people search for podcasts. So if you type in, you know, sports stats or something, we might come up more quickly. And then Hot Takedown Nation grows and you have more people to talk about the show too. So please leave a review and a rating. It really does help others discover the program. While you're on iTunes, of course, search for the other 538 podcasts. If you want to hear more about Daniel Murphy from me and Neil, search for Panic City, our Mets spinoff pod. Mina, how can they find the Bachelorette podcast?
That's the Bill Barnwell show, so look it up under that.
And there are certain Bachelorette episodes,
yeah,
right?
Do it once a week.
All right, excellent. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast, Joe Q Public, is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance this week from Tony Chow and Jorge Estrada. Our sports intern at 538 this summer is Setridge Crawford. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.